And now the story of Remember Shuffle, a 2000s pop culture podcast and the two hosts who talk it through. It's our Arrested Development episode.
It's Britney, bitch.
And Iraq, everywhere like such as.
I'm supposed to be the franchise player, and we're in here talking about practice.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
Out, Charlie!
Our next door neighbors are foreign countries.
I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers.
Thank you.
Now watch this drive.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Remember Shuffle, your podcast about 2000 pop culture, its lasting impact or lack thereof, depending on what we're talking about, and nostalgia.
My name is Ben. With me, as always, is my co-host, Giordano.
And today, we are joined by two guests from one of our favorite pods. You might know them from their history work, Hell of Presidents, and their recently dropped Hell on Earth, or one of our favorite pods, Chapo Trap House. We are joined by none other than Matt Chrisman and Chris Wade.
Hello, guys. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hey.
And today we are discussing one of my favorite shows, probably my favorite 2000s situational comedy program, Arrested Development.
So yeah, we'll begin this episode the same way we begin every episode, which is to describe why are we doing this? Why should you care about Arrested Development? I think it's probably one of the best political satires of American decline and one of the things that makes the show so ahead of its time. So the Bluths are rich, right? But not because George Bluth is this great businessman, but because he's unscrupulous and he's good at doing crime. And so his incompetent children then just fight for the spoils of their crumbling real estate development empire. So it's the ultimate fail son comedic forerunner. You know, before there was Succession or Schitt's Creek or Yellowstone, we had the Bluths.
So yeah, you guys talk on Chapo a lot about the figure, this archetype of the fail son in America, its place in America today. And so I was wondering if I could ask y'all, what do you think Arrested Development has to say about the fail son in specific or American decline generally?
Well, one thing is that fail sons come in various different stripes. There's not just one model for one, because you have on Arrested Development some a rainbow, a panoply of failed children with different specific responses to the psychological condition of growing up with a lot of inherited and assumed wealth and power. And they show the various different ways that it can just turn you into a ineffectual monster, as opposed to your parents who were effectual monsters.
Yeah, I was immediately just thinking about between Job and Michael. Like, Job would be the more immediately recognizable fail son, just bumbling through a series of failed projects with unlimited resources to back himself up. Whereas Michael's failure is believing the myth to be true.
Yes.
That, as you said, you know, his father's real business was crimes, and he has mistakenly believed that the business is business.
Mm-hmm.
And that being responsible and being effectual is the way to get forward, when over and over and over it is proven that, no, the way to get ahead in the family is by being as wildly unscrupulous as possible. The thing that he tries and over again to avoid doing, but must do to meet his reality.
My favorite Job fail project is, of course, the bees.
Bees, Michael. Bees.
Yes. He develops this entire plan just because he misheard the word beads. He misheard one consonant.
Bees?
Beads.
Beads.
And it just leads to this Rube Goldberg of things that, you know, they try and call back to in season four. We'll close with.
Column collapse.
Yeah, for one, I think we know who the color blue in that rainbow fails.
Yes.
It's always very funny seeing the way that the Bluth children have been messed up and traumatized by their parents then be passed on to George Michael and maybe in the same way.
Yeah, and between them, of course, George Michael has his father's disease of believing that earnestness is a way to accomplish anything, whereas maybe is perhaps the one in the entire family who sees everything the clearest and knows that scamming is the only way to make sense of the hand that she's been dealt.
Yeah, she internalized the correct lesson.
Yes, exactly.
The other reason we're doing this is that this show was, for a network sitcom, incredibly ambitious, and it really pushed the boundaries of the genre. So you had jokes that were set up weeks in advance. You had these elaborate callbacks. I think it really developed its own language of double entendres and wordplay and puns. And of course, even the the title, Arrested Development, can be read in at least three different ways, where the Bluth company, which does development, has stopped, and the family is without their slush fund and in a state of limbo. On another level, you have the children of George and Lucille who cannot really grow up. They're in this perpetual state of fail-son adolescence. And of course, George Bluth is physically arrested in the first episode of the show.
Yes.
Also, there's a subtextual appreciation for mid-90s backpack rap.
Expand on that. Say more.
You guys don't know Arrested Development, Mr. Wendell?
No.
You got you children. You don't remember. There was a rap group called Arrested Development from like 1995, and they all wore like overalls.
Whoa.
And Mr. Wendell was like a shaman type figure.
Yeah,
in it, right?
It's a rap song about a shaman, basically a hobo, like a wise hobo.
See, this speaks to my frame of reference because I mostly know the idea of Mr. Wendell from a extended Venture Brothers reference.
Mm. There you go.
Nice. A rapping shaman sounds like something they would bring into Arrested Development season 4.
Yes.
That sounds like a plot point. There.
We'll have to go out on one of their songs.
Yeah.
So our next question for you guys is there a favorite feature of the show, like stylistically, that you really like? So, you know, we mentioned the double entendres, some of the meta commentary, the elaborate callbacks, the interchangeable catchphrases that move between characters. Was there like a stylistic feature that you enjoyed?
Yeah, I mean, I think I always enjoy comedies that go out of their way to create their own vocabulary and syntax so that literally the language used within the universe of the show is, you know, kind of like adjacent to reality. Mm-hmm. And I think that Arrested Development really does that in a way that is often so complicated, but always feels completely effortless. Mm-hmm. And it'll be things like, I mean, I'm not going to be able to pick a specific example off the top of my head, but it'll be things where like they repeat the same phrase for some reason over and over throughout the course of the episode. And then at the very end, somebody says it again in a way where it has become the singular punchline to the entire episode and has a completely different context once the plot of the episode has fully revealed itself. And it always feels so magical. And even like the bees thing of like, mm-hmm. just in those episodes where they're talking it and just everybody's going bees,
yes,
over and over again. And it's just every single time it becomes funnier and funnier. That always really gets me in these episodes. It's just like the dictionary of the world of Arrested Development is different from the dictionary of our world. And I always appreciate that.
Well, that was a freebie.
But take a good look, because it's the last time. And say goodbye to these.
Who's the attorneys? You're going to get some hop-ons.
Her?
Come on!
I mean, the second episode of the whole show, they do that with the two lines, there's always money in the banana stand, and
yes,
no touching in prison, where the final thing before the tag is him screaming it because there was money in the banana stand, and finally touching him, like grabbing him in prison, and the guard shouting, no touching.
Yes. Yes, and those two things, the same thing, yeah, like two wildly different things that you think are just quirky running jokes that they're just doing to be silly, and then at the very end, combined to be like, oh no, this is a perfectly constructed logic puzzle that has met in the end in a way that you could have never expected.
Yeah. And it's so much better than whatever, like the cheesy catchphrase of how you doing from Joey or what have you. That's just used to put on t-shirts. But yeah, Matt, favorite recurring gag or comedic feature of Arrested Development?
The way that they all have different ways to pretend to be a chicken.
Yes! Okay.
And none of them are in any respect similar to what a chicken is like.
Okay. When we were thinking up questions, I told Giordano, I want to ask them who they think has the best chicken dance. And Giordano said to me, what kind of psycho would remember all four chicken dances?
I was like, I remember the chicken dances. And Job's was by far the best, where he's clapping his hands in front of him.
Yes.
I think I like Lindsay's the best, where she's kind of doing the bell kick sways with her legs.
And she's doing the waving her hand in front of her forehead.
See, I actually like George Sr.'s the best because cuckoo ka-cha is just a very funny sound effect. And the way that he explodes his arms outwards, it's great.
What's this?
Oh, Michael's scared to ask out Sally.
No, I'm not. Chum.
This is priceless.
Go, 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 go
just telling him.
Look, I haven't found the right girl. When I do, I will ask her out.
Has anyone in this family ever seen her?
My wife, Molly, had just thrown on some Arrested Development episodes the other week, even before we started talking about that. And the chicken thing was the thing where I was like, this is such a weird thing to do. It is like such a confident shot to call of being like, we can construct this incredibly specific running joke over the course of three seasons that you only really get, like when you're first watching the show in the third season, like, mm-hmm. They all have different specific, yeah, it takes so long to set up, but the payoff, while being funny in just like the silly performances of themselves, it's really some next level stuff that I don't think almost any other network comedy has ever achieved something of that high level and that stupid simultaneously.
Yeah.
I was listening to Will Arnett in an interview, and they asked him if people ask him about Arrested Development, and he goes, yeah, you know, it's great. Most of the times that fans come up to me, they just start doing the chicken dance. But he is saying that's great with his mouth and just having his eyes betray him, as you can imagine.
That's great.
It's really great. I love it.
It makes me wonder, like, these are the kinds of things that I need, like, a 7-hour interview with. I'm sure this exists, but I've never tracked it down with, what's his name? Mitchell Horowitz? Michael. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mitchell Horowitz. Being like, on the first day that they all got together to start shooting Arrested Development, did he have to go to the core cast and be like, all right, so over the course of the next 3 years, we are going to develop a running bit about dancing like a chicken, and we need all six of you to sit down right now and come up with different specific ways to call somebody a chicken that specifically do not look like chickens, and we will, over the course of the 4 years that we are producing the show, slowly reveal them, but we need to set them now. Or did it just come up naturally? I would like to know.
Yeah. No, he is a true master of the long game, without a doubt.
Yes.
And one of the great sins of season 4 is that we were teased with George Michael's chicken dance, but did not get to see it. Unforgivable.
Yes.
Moving on, we're going to just briefly describe the show, and then we'll do our little thematic analysis that we like to do on the show. So, as the narrator lays out in the theme song, Arrested Development tells the story of the Bluth family, a rich family who lost everything and the one son who has to keep them all together. The Bluths are a family of riches-to-rags narcissists, with the exception of one son, maybe, kind of, Michael, played by Jason Bateman, who acts as kind of the straight man of the show in the early seasons, and then some other things happen when they move to Netflix. And one of the things that's really notable about this show is this ensemble cast. There was cast inflation in the sitcom from the 90s to the 2000s. Seinfeld has 4, Friends has 6, but there are 9 main cast members in Arrested Development, as well as a whole bunch of recurring guest stars that are in a bunch of episodes, like Barry Zuckerkorn, played by the Fonz, mm-hmm. is there a lot. Just some of the characters. I'm not going to read them all because it would be tedious, but you have George Sr., the family patriarch and criminal who's arrested in the pilot. Job, fan favorite, the eldest son, the fail son magician, and incredibly lonely narcissist. And maybe my favorite character is, of course, Dr. Tobias Funke, the disgraced analyst and therapist, the character that everyone knows is gay except for him, and mm-hmm. an aspiring actor.
Yeah, Tobias really is a very prescient character in that he embodies an archetype that would only become more true as time goes on, and one that Felix from Chapo has often talked about on our show, is that from all walks of life, from basically every class orientation in America, that the highest aspiration that everybody secretly has is to have a media career.
Yes.
And Tobias is a trained medical doctor. I mean, the amount to which he is reputable could be debated, but the only thing that he wants to do is be like the worst actor in the world.
Yes. He wants to be frightened inmate number 2.
Yes.
Plot-wise, on a surface level, we typically get some kind of instigating event involving either the faltering business or George Sr.'s court case, which the family scrambles to address. And typically the ABC plots revolve around the emotional fallout to the Bluth children as they claw at trying to get respect from one another. Buster from his mother, Job from Michael, Lindsay from her mother, Tobias from his wife. Everybody has this insane need to validate themselves to the others, except for the parents, typically. Yeah, Lucille and George, because they're the ones doing the psychological damage, like Matt had said earlier.
I just have a quick question for our guests. When did you guys watch this show for the first time, and what did you think of?
I watched it as it was on terrestrial television on the Fox network.
Nice.
On Sunday night. I would watch that shit.
Nice, respect.
And I was like, damn, this is really good. This is the best show, I think.
Did you end up watching the Super Bowl or the 4 dumped episodes that aired off opposite it?
I think I probably watched the Super Bowl, but I did eventually watch all of them.
I got to issue a small correction. It was not the Super Bowl. It was the opening ceremonies of the Olympics that they dumped.
Okay,
well, then I definitely watched those. I wasn't going to watch the fucking Olympics. That's lame.
Yeah. I think also 2006, that might have been a Winter Olympics too. So,
yeah. Some friends have suggested we do a Olympics episode, and we're like, well, we might wait on that one.
Yeah.
This is a little post the show's purview, but I will go to the bat for the Danny Boyle directed 2012 Olympic opening ceremonies.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man, those are wild.
You've got Daniel Craig jumping out of a helicopter with the Queen to parachute in. There's a part of that opening ceremony where a bunch of 19th century industrialists in top hats raise smokestacks out of the ground in a simulated.
Kenneth Branagh plays Isambard Kingdom Brunel, who is like one of the chief engineers of the 19th century English Second Industrial Revolution.
Yes, it is. It is literally a paean to doing a demonic summoning ritual of the satanic mills of England. There's Shrek's there for a moment because he's Scottish. Sorry, this is a big. But no, if we're talking about Olympic opening ceremonies, I remember this.
They have kids sick children swing dancing on hospital beds in praise of the NHS. Yes. They have Mr. Bean doing pantomime, proving that he's still got it. He's still got the sauce, Mr. Bean.
Oh man, the 2012 Olympic opening ceremonies are a whole ass vibe.
Oh God, I remember the Pet Shop Boys on a little popmobile, architectural outfits like these big weird giant. Shoulder padded things like big weird sunglasses singing West End Girls.
Yeah. Oh boy.
Yeah, I'm getting like a precise flashback of that opening ceremony. It's absolutely the most memorable one.
Yes. It is truly bonkers, literally, because they've got Dizzy Rascal out there performing bonkers.
Damn. I wasn't expecting this kind of Proustian memory of Olympics during Arrested Development episode.
I mean, once you brought it up, it just all came back to me like a diamond bullet.
Yeah. So the reason I asked this question is a lot of people say the reason this show failed on television is because it was made for binging before that was how we consumed television. The rate of jokes that hit per minute, the callbacks and call forwards, people said like this was just ready for binging, but that's not what people were doing yet. Which I find is kind of funny because when they move it to a streaming service associated with binging, it's not good.
Well, we'll get to that because I first watched this. I caught this in the era where I was watching this on DVD box sets in college. Definitely a recurring, like another sense memory of my college era was like waking up to and coming back out to like our apartment or dorm, like common area apartment living room to the Arrested Development DVD menu playing on loop. But yeah, I mean, the way that it's constructed is so ambitious that basically unless you start at the first episode, there's almost no way to drop in. And I think each individual episode is funny on its own merits, but the true scope of the hilarity, like the depth of what is going on is almost impossible to clock unless you have watched every episode multiple times. I get what you're saying about the binging era, but there's something about the bingeable TV that isn't even quite the same anymore, because to me, most of the thing that comes from bingeable TV is something that you throw on to not pay attention to.
Yeah.
That you're watching 10 episodes at a time because it takes 10 episodes of a binged TV show to deliver about 2 episodes worth of content. But you can absorb it by the fact that you're paying, what, like the 40% attention to the show the entire time.
No, that's a great point. Like most bingeable TV don't have the ambition or the level of detail. Like I was mapping out some of these episodes in preparation for this, and the third episode, Bringing Up Buster, has at least like 5 plots that all interweave, because you have something to do with the case, you have Buster moving out of Lucille's house and like swearing for the first time with his siblings.
I'm mom and I want to shoot down everything you say so I feel good about myself.
Look who's ragging on the old lady.
Hey.
Finally,
I'm an uptight
Buster. You old horny slut.
Well, no one's gonna top that.
You have maybe Steve Holt and George Michael love triangle, and you have Tobias directing the play, and then even a plot point about Lindsay wanting to hold on to a dress that she had purchased, which gets involved in the play, and it all comes together in 21 or 22 minutes. Wrapping up our description here, the show, like Chris just said, it was traditional in that it featured these non-serialized plots that you could tune in and see one story told end to end, but it also had these really long-running gags, really high payoffs in the climax of individual episodes, and gags that were developed over the course of entire seasons. It's not like something, you know, it's what's like a stupidly successful sitcom that sucks? I don't know. It's not like The Big Bang Theory where you can turn on your nerds saying dumb things.
Yeah, I'd be curious to what you think of the relation between like the way that television has changed watching and the enduring appeal of Arrested Development, because it is like categorically different from the streaming model in that you're not just getting this fire hose of content, but it still works really well there because it is so possible to revisit it. Like, it's endlessly rewatchable. It's one of those things that every time you see it, you pick out something new that was done very intentionally and is its own joke. But you, even though I've seen like the main three seasons probably front to back, I don't know, at this point, like 6 or 7 times, there's still new stuff in every single episode, or stuff that is only funnier the more that you rewatch it, which is something that is outside of what we understand the evolution of TV to be, like something that is meant to be returned to over and over again.
Yeah, and it is wild that was from the era of shows just going on television, you know, and then you watch them and then you go off about your day when like a single viewing is just not going to ever get you even close to the content of an episode.
Yeah, so let's move on to our thematic analysis that we love to do of stuff on this program.
You know, with Arrested Development, if you think of the show as a metaphor for America, it is about a family who has inherited immense wealth acquired through criminal means that is bickering amongst themselves on how to divide the spoils as the bottom falls out. This sort of plot seems to resonate better and better as time goes on. You can look at Arrested Development as sort of a model home for a show like Succession or Schitt's Creek or Yellowstone.
Yeah.
That plot like really speaks to Americans for some reason. And I think that we are the Bluths. Globally speaking, we are this rich family who has criminally inherited wealth and is now fighting amongst ourselves for our piece of the inheritance. And we're also deeply sad and lonely like the Bluths.
On an individual level.
And our question here was, why do you think Americans can't get enough of these riches to rags stories? Is it Schadenfreude, wish fulfillment, subconscious identification,
cope?
All of those, I think. I think they all play a role. I think yes to all of that. I think there's a desire to see the rich as not any better, and in fact worse than regular people. And then also the acknowledgement that everybody has some dynamic like that in their own life as well.
There's also, I feel like, this eternal dream in American culture and American pop culture to imagine yourself adjacent to failure and evil, but not be failure and evil, you know?
Yes.
It's always your neighbor, you know, mm-hmm. who's the one who is not quite as good, not quite as successful, not quite as upstanding as you, but never yourself. I think that that's like kind of an eternal Freudian element of American society is always like, we understand that there is something wrong here. It's just, it's not me. It's those guys across the street, you know?
Yeah. No, I love that. That's a great reading. Yeah. Even within the show, I feel like it's not just our eccentric Bluth family who represent the decline of America. I think it shows every major American institution as just so comically incompetent. Like, you have George Sr., a guy who just has this insane propensity for putting things in walls, and the government can't put him away. They send in moles afterward. They can't build a case against George Sr. You have the government, you have law enforcement, the film industry, the legal system. They're all these bumbling criminals in one way, shape, or form. I love his portrayal of the police, and it's the police constantly getting confused between George and Oscar. And they always take down Oscar. It doesn't matter if he's walking out of the police station. They always take him down in the exact same way, with that fifth cop hitting him with the baton.
Even the medical institutions, like my favorite running gag is Dan Castellaneta as the guy delivering terrible news that turns out to be a misdirection.
Yes.
Which I think is obviously just a good classic, you know, almost like Borscht Belty pun gag. But it is also, it does speak to a sensation that I'm sure everybody has had with interacting with the medical institutions of America, of it being impossible to get a straight answer about anything in very heightened situations where it's about your health, whether you are sick, whether there's something very dangerously wrong. And the way that you have to get this information is dealing with an absolutely Byzantine system that makes no logical sense.
Excuse me, Mr. Bluth. We lost him. He just got away from us. I'm sorry.
Can we go in there?
If you want. Not a lot to see.
I mean, not for you, but for us.
What the doctor meant to say was that George Sr. had escaped, a feat he'd accomplished by using the family's portable stairway vehicle.
How's my son?
He's going to be all right.
Oh,
thank God.
Finally, some good news.
There's no other
guy.
Way to take that.
Yes, he's lost his left hand, so he's going to be all right.
You what son of a bitch! I hate this doctor!
How is he, doctor?
It looks like he's dead.
Oh, my God!
Oh, little guy. The tears aren't coming. The tears just aren't coming.
Okay. Just to be clear, it looks like he's dead or he is dead?
It just looks like he's dead. He's got like blue paint on him or something, but he's going to be fine.
What is wrong with you?
Yeah, what if you had to get important medical information from a Marx brother, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I think the show points to this phenomenon of American decline explicitly and really well. There's this great throwaway line that I think I noticed maybe for the first time on this rewatch that stuck in my brain.
You know, say what you will about America, $13 still gets you a hell of a lot of mice.
Like, yeah, you can buy mice for $13 and do God knows what them, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many like classic little gags about the, you know, expectations versus reality of this kind of ensconced family. I mean, the classic, you know, how much could a banana cost joke, which I find coming back over and over, especially in the last year or so as inflation has become another, has come back into the popular consciousness. There have been so many things where I'm just like muttering that in my head. How much could a banana cost?
Yeah, for sure. And related to decline, but a thing that the show treats discreetly is, of course, the Iraq War. So we've talked on our show before about how this was a pretty weird time when Michael Moore is getting booed at the Oscars by liberal Hollywood. There certainly wasn't a ton of political satire about the Iraq War in those early days as it was happening. And I feel like certainly not much good satire. You can listen to our episode on American Idiot. But I think Arrested Development really does a good job of satirizing the U.S.'s tremendous incompetence and bad faith pitching of the war really brilliantly. I think it does it because it's not micro-targeted at individuals. It's not SNL casting the Grim Reaper as Steve Bannon, you know, corn-cobbing his ass. It's about entire institutions and systems. And it, in true Arrested Development style, it starts out really slow, boiling the frog slowly. In season one, Michael notices that on a news report about the war, that a home looks exactly like the crumbling model home he lives in. And that's a payoff that's like 8 episodes later, something crazy. It's 8 weeks in the, you know, terrestrial television sphere, you get George Sr. saying, you know, I may have committed some light treason. Given that this ran 03 to 06, which is the height of the war, what do y'all think of the show's treatment of the Iraq War as it was happening?
Well, as a young anti-war lib, I was always excited when they would do any kind of commentary on the war, in part because that was so rare and the cultural atmosphere was so reactionary around the conflict that they were really the only place. Although, you know, a lot of it ends up being in that liberal vein of, you know, like, oh, the Humvees that we're sending to Iraq don't have enough armor for our troops, that kind of thing.
George Sr. came across a U.S. Army combat Humvee and the Popemobile. And he decided to escape in the bulletproof one.
Finds out that a fake Popemobile can't stop real bullets.
Thank God I wasn't in the Humvee.
The thing that I remember most about this era is, yeah, the thing that Matt was saying is that it was just the overculture around it was just draped in this feeling of stifling inevitability, that there wasn't any kind of pop cultural dissent in the sense of feeling like, well, what could there be? Of course, this is like the obvious and correct thing that must be done. And so getting anything that even like referenced the obvious absurdity of everything that was going on just felt like almost getting this like libidinal surge of joy, like a pellet popping out of the rat feeder or something. If you just to get any sense that anybody else somewhere was like, hey, this is all kind of crazy, right? And then also just the idea of building a SoCal-style suburban housing development in Iraq just felt so perfect in that moment where the phrase McMansion was still felt very new and satirical in pop culture.
Yes.
At this point now, it seems more that the satire is just about talking about it at all than really having much of a point of view. But it's hard to overstate how much that felt deeply subversive in the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe my favorite anti-Iraq War joke in this is the photo of Tobias's balls about the WMDs.
Oh, yes. Those are balls.
I get that there's definitely an element of lib wish fulfillment there, because it's all about the Natsit stick breaking into Tobias's phone, illegally grabbing this picture from him, mistaking it for WMDs. But in the lib fantasy of Arrested Development, the airstrikes get called off once the Patriot Act Natsit stick recognizes that it's balls, which has, yeah, definitely a big element of lib wish fulfillment in there.
I think maybe the thing that I feel is the most subversive about it now is in a moment of overt and constant troop worship, the character that they chose to associate with the army was Buster.
Yes.
To have like the most comically bumbling man-child of the family be the one that they send off, or they send off to the army, whether or not he actually, you know, goes.
We had a half day. We had a half day at army.
Yes. I mean, hey, he learned Arabic, right?
And then later, if we want to get into season four, becomes a drone operator. The perfect character in this series to associate with that level of remote violence, you know?
Mm-hmm. Getting into our third theme here, I just want to talk a little bit about land development in Southern California. I just feel like the setting of land development in California always seems to be an area of focus in fiction. The goal is to take one of the most beautiful natural landscapes in the world, perfect for human habitation, and pave over it to make room for these McMansions and highways. Like you see in Chinatown, other noir, and Arrested Development feels like it's commenting on that corrupting influence that America has on our own Mediterranean coast. You know, the Bluths, they work in real estate development. The family itself, they live in this model home, which is chronically falling apart because it's so poorly built in a neighborhood called Sudden Valley. Plot lines often seem to revolve around like environmentalism, you know, where Lindsay is trying to protest the Bluths bulldozing old trees to build a second model home, or Lindsay attending the wetlands charities, which she initially thinks is a cause to dry the wetlands.
When they're faced with a deadline to build a second model home, which begs the question, why do you need a second model? Isn't one model enough to show what you will do for the rest of the thing? They just build a facade, a fake facade. It's all just, it's a machine that just runs on crime and debt. Matt, since you recently moved to California, I was wondering if we could get your view on how this show treats real estate development in California.
I mean, I have not developed any real estate there, so I don't really know specifically how it corresponds to reality, but it certainly gets the vibe correct of just constant scamming and building crap in increasingly remote areas. I also enjoy, when I got there, going, one of the first things I ended up doing, not on purpose, but it just ended up working out that way, was to go to Huntington Beach, which is sort of where that's where the bulk of this show takes place. Mm-hmm. And it definitely feels like a place that would be populated by the Bluths. You can imagine a mother boy being held in one of the hotels or something.
I think one of the things that's so interesting about just development patterns in Southern California is that, obviously, self-evident point, it's built around the car. It's built around the personal automobile, but it is the place in America that is best suited for like walkable urbanism and bike infrastructure, or hell, the fucking bus. Where would you rather wait for the bus? It's beautiful, sunny Southern California or Detroit. And we just took this tremendous opportunity and paved over the thing so that I can have a big ass house and my fucking car to show off my conspicuous consumption. And how does this show the Blues riches to rags thing? They have to downgrade to the fucking stair car, right?
Yes. And Michael biking, going out of his way to bike around, seemingly only to show that he is the kind of guy who bikes.
Yes. He's, especially when he's trying to show that he's at his most virtuous, he's biking and there's just no infrastructure for it at all.
Yeah.
I think it's funny when we talk about cities and their drawbacks, they're typically immutable and natural, right? Chicago is windy. Miami is in a swamp. Seattle rains all the time. LA's problem is that there's too much traffic. It is a man-made problem with an easy solution.
I think there's also another element of the housing thing where obviously it's a great joke that they live in a model home that is shoddily built and falling apart, but it's also about that the homes that they are building are not really meant to be lived in. They are a repository of value. That is their big project, is to like not create something that is a home, but create something that is a business for themselves. And I think that there is also an element of it that is like, I don't know, housing homes, especially those kinds of developments, make the people who create them live in them, and most especially not even live in them, buy them. Mm-hmm. Insane.
Yeah.
I have some family in Southern California who live in things like this, and the way that having to treat your home as a commodity, especially as they get older and have to think about it explicitly like that, like what are we doing with this commodity piece that we have lived in for a long time, but now we have to think about like how we are going to spend our retirement and stuff like that. It is genuinely insanity making for people. And I think that that's one of the things that it gets at, is that the family is in the business of building houses, but these houses are not homes. You know? Yes.
Yeah, that sort of dovetails nicely into our next theme here.
Yeah, so this is one that I wish maybe I could have put a few more reps in the Discourse Dojo in, because it's a little half-cooked here. But I feel like Arrested Development is this show that is so much about delusional fantasy in all these different levels. I put in our notes, this is Oedipus, first as tragedy, then as farce, where the character of Oedipus in that tragedy, everything he thinks about himself is wrong. He thinks he's Corinthian when he's really Theban. He thinks that he's the solution to Thetis' problems when he's really their cause, because he's having sex with his mother. And we see this in Arrested Development at the individual level, characters just having these delusional fantasies about themselves, most obviously with Tobias, who everyone else knows that he's gay but him. He wants to live out this fantasy of an actor. But even Michael, like you guys said at the top of the show, like Michael has this fantasy that earnestness and effectiveness is the way forward. I think the show comments on this in so many interesting ways, with Job, who's literally a profferer of illusions. He sells fantasy, even though he has three fucking tricks, which is pennies, dove, fire. And in true Arrested Development fashion, they kind of heighten it with these other layers, where you have Mrs. Featherbottom is Tobias's fantasy of living out Mrs. Doubtfire to see his daughter, but all of the other characters embrace the fantasy because they need him to clean the house and do their laundry. The show comments on it on so many interesting ways. The show takes place in fucking La La Land, where they make the fantasy, where, mm-hmm. as the tour guide at the Warner Bros. Studios told me, they turn dreams into celluloid reality. That's a real phrase that an adult human male said to me.
And like you just said, Chris, the model home itself is a fantasy. It is a projection of an ideal life that is meant to sell you on something, the idea of having your own McMansion. And then as they live in it, it's found to be a paper tiger. It falls apart in almost every episode in some way.
Yeah, and I think when it comes to this idea of fantasy, so much of sitcom's humor is based upon misunderstandings of other characters. But here we have, in true Arrested Development fashion, three different kinds of misunderstanding. Misunderstanding yourself, misunderstanding others, and then deliberately misunderstanding others in the case of Mrs. Featherbottom. It's fantasy upon fantasy upon fantasy. And the reason I joke that it's Oedipus or Oedipus, I forget what I said, it's Oedipus first as tragedy, now as farce, is that the show also has its many different kinds of incest plot lines.
Yeah, and I think that the whole environment of the show is also very particularly of that kind of post 9/11 moment, where kind of everybody in America had to ask, wait, is everything that we understood about the country also a fantasy?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is something about, living in, I'm trying to phase this in not too pretentious a way, but there is something about living in America in the 21st century where you have to confront at all points, like, is everything made up? Is there meaning to anything here? And then scramble to build an identity around that.
Our next question, I guess, is like, how do you read the model home? Like, why is it funny to you? How do you take in the symbol of the model home?
Yeah, the idea of setting your dysfunctional family in a literal fake house is both so obvious, but also wildly genius. There's also a season 4 joke that I really appreciate, where Tobias and Lindsay move into an actual mansion.
Yes.
And then can never find each other inside of it. Just commenting on the, you have these gigantic houses that should be a home, and yet you can never see each other inside. Again, yeah. A fairly obvious joke, but played off very, very humorously, I think, in that season.
Yeah, why don't we actually talk a little bit about season 4? Because that can get us into the reception of the show at the time, its influences, the echoes in the culture from Arrested Development. And Chris, I know when we were corresponding before this episode, you said you wanted to mount your defense of season 4. So you have the floor.
Yeah, I mean, I think Arrested Development season 4 is actually pretty genius. And we were talking about the difference between streaming and terrestrial TV. I think it's one of the few things that actually uses the inherent nature of streaming and binging quite to its advantage. The big thing about it is it has this kind of elliptical storytelling where each episode is focused on a specific character and gives you little glimpses at what's going on with the other characters. And it's only through seeing the entire season that you get the full scope of the story. And it is, I thought, there definitely is like a weird energy to it. It's different from the original three seasons in terms of vibe, tone, pacing, which I think people responded most negatively to because they just wanted more of the classic thing. But I think in using that, it being like a perfectly functioning puzzle where everything does indeed pay off in that classic Arrested Development way, even though it fits together a bit differently. I mean, I thought it was genius. And it was also because every single person on that show has become an even bigger star than they had been before, some in quite unexpected ways. They had different access to their cast than what they had in the original three-season run, and they had to plot everything very carefully about who was available when. So even just in that production standpoint, I find it a work of genius TV production. But yeah, I mostly just think that the structure of it is so entrancing and pays off so well.
So you prefer the original cut to the re-release, re-edited one?
Oh, the re-edited version is garbage. It is absolute trash, and it is a classic example of Netflix having all the resources in the world but second-guessing every single decision that they make.
Mm-hmm.
The recut is not worth watching. The original cut, which is impossible to find on the Netflix setup right now. You have to go through insane hoops to actually watch the season four in the original cut anymore. However, season five, I never finished watching.
It's brutal. Do you know how it ends? Do you know how they do Buster?
I only watched like three episodes of season five.
They turn Buster into a literal murderer. He murders Lucille too.
Oh, God. But season four, I think, is quite genius.
Matt, what are your thoughts on season four?
And I never really warmed to it. I think I get the point that it is incredibly intricately constructed, but I think it kind of left me cold for that reason. I never really got into it. And the new characters, It felt like it was like the Terry Crews' guy. It just felt like it was too, it was trying too hard to be relevant to the current moment. And like, yeah. It just didn't do it for me.
Yeah, I think the trying too hard to be of the current moment that sticks in my head the most is late in season four, maybe delivers this rant verbatim that was going around the internet circa 2013. That was an unhinged sorority girl letter that she had sent to her other sorority sister.
Oh, yes.
And maybe just delivers it verbatim. And I remember thinking it was kind of funny in the moment, rolling my eyes a bit, but thinking this is going to age like fine milk.
Yeah, I totally appreciate that. Again, the stuff of season four where I'm like, damn, that's so smart and impressive is what I really appreciate. And I am the kind of comedy nerd where I can watch something where the main thing that I'm getting at is like, wow, that is incredibly clever how they pulled that off, more than I'm like actually laughing at it. Okay, so at the beginning of this episode, I was talking about how one of the things that stands out for Arrested Development to me is that it has its own specific world of language and thought that exists totally onto itself. And the things that you're talking about now, when we go to season four, where even with the exact same creative team, they are now like, the thing that people liked about Arrested Development is stuff like the Iraq war thing. So we should lean into commenting on literally things that are happening. And that really presages a whole new mood of TV comedy, of streaming comedy, where things feel so plucked from the discourse that it is like, God, please have an original idea.
Yeah.
Show me something I haven't seen before. And to that end, yes, I think that the later seasons of Arrested Development go off the rails in the exact least favorite ways of TV writing right now.
And that's actually a nice segue for another question that we have, which is, why can't streaming services make a pure sitcom? I feel like most of the streaming services are going to do comedy dramas. They're going to put out your stuff like, I don't know, The Bear on Hulu, which is supposed to be a comedy, but leans really heavily on the drama. Network TV is still making sitcoms, and the sitcoms that streaming services do make are them stuff like Fuller House or whatever, that 90s show that just dropped, which I do think that these reboots kind of have Arrested Development Season 4 in their DNA. Arrested Development Season 4 was one of the first ones when the streaming service went picking for scraps of IP, and that seems to be all that they make now. So I guess, do you guys have any ideas for why don't streaming services really make pure sitcoms anymore?
One thing I've been thinking about recently is how companies like Netflix start off as tech companies, and then they get into the content game, and so they are outside of the system of Hollywood business and storytelling that has developed as its own industrial culture over the course of, you know, now over a century. And I do think that there is an element to that where there are ways of doing things that have created recognizable media to us that have literally defined the grammar of how we understand filmic and televisual storytelling works that I think a lot of these companies just don't have. I mean, they can hire people who have been from that industry, that they can literally lift whole creative teams. But I suspect that there is just something about that process of approaching these things as tech companies and not as traditional media companies that loses something in translation. And I think that that it also probably has to do with the way that they, at the very highest level, structure their priorities of what is a success or not to them. That is just 5 degrees of the steering wheel in a different direction than from what we know how traditional media companies work. And that experience of watching TV and movies is so deeply ingrained in us that we understand. It is like, it is a different language. You know, it is like learning a foreign language that is adjacent to English or whatever, but it is its own thing because it is conveyed in a different way. And I think that that's one of the reasons that the streaming company stuff just always feels slightly off. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they can come out with something that is quite good in its own way. Even down to like a thing that I always think about, like Netflix stuff, is the production design always seems weirdly off. The way that I always think about it, like watching a Netflix show always looks like they have given their production team a budget of $300 million, but with the stipulation that they can only spend it at Party City. So like everything always looks really expensive and really cheap at the same time in a way that like an HBO show just doesn't. So that's my theory about it.
That's really interesting because I've always found the inverse of that to be true. I've worked for a number of Canadian television broadcasters, and if you ever find a company whose focus is making content, you'll find that all of them have apps that never seem to work perfectly right. You can never find the content that you were just watching, even if it's the only thing that you watch. It never goes back to the place that you were in the episode.
I watched Sunset Boulevard for the first time recently, you know, a movie about making movies. And you see how in the golden age of Hollywood, everything's done in-house. Every stage, they have all of these employees that they really want to do a good job in-house. There's no subcontractors. There's no consultants that are involved. And I think over the course of the 80s, 90s, and so on, you see more and more VPs of this, that, and the other. You know, the big studios sell off their property in Los Angeles to developers, most of them predominantly. And I think that the tech company getting into content is kind of the next natural outgrowth of this phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, just to bring it back to sitcoms for a second, I want to mention that it does seem like sitcoms are a dead art form. It's like disco or jazz or something. Like, I don't know that we're making...
I don't know if you can throw jazz in there, dude.
Well, you know what I mean. It's not as popular. It seems to be done by like esoteric people.
It's a niche thing now. Mm-hmm.
Right. It's been relegated to animation, I think, is what's happened. If you want to make a sitcom and not a dramedy, you know, you're like a Rick and Morty or a Family Guy or something.
Well, not anymore Rick and Morty, probably.
No. Yeah. But because sitcoms are about to die and no longer be a thing, it's so weird that right before that happens, we get these incredibly evolutionary shows like Arrested Development. Like Arrested Development is like a dinosaur that made a big evolutionary jump right before the meteor hits Earth.
One I will stand up for, and I don't know if anybody's watched this, but one streaming service straight sitcom that I saw last year that I thought worked really well was the show Reboot.
Yes, I enjoyed that too, I was going to say. That's not bad at all.
And I think it's very telling that it is literally about the same thing. It is a sitcom about making Arrested Development season 4. It's not actually Arrested Development, but the plot is a streaming service picks up a 90s like step-by-step style sitcom to reboot another season for a streaming series. And it's about the cast reassembling. It's about the young writer who chose this property to try to reboot it. And it works really well. The cast is, it's funny. It's got good straight sitcom style plots of misunderstanding and sexual hijinks and shit like that. It's pretty clever with its premise of rebooting an old sitcom in a fun, surprising way. So that is one where I'm like, wow, they did it. They made a new idea sitcom with brand new characters that totally works and is totally a 7 out of 10 entertaining.
Nice. What service is it on? Just out of curiosity.
Hulu.
Oh, okay.
It's an actual sitcom.
Yeah, they really did it. There's even a joke in there. One of my favorite jokes in it is the kind of meta joke that the VP in charge of the reboot sitcom describes how she got there and is like, oh, well, you know, I was the VP of product development at Chungle before Chungle got bought by Bleep Lorp, where I became the VP of ad sales technology. And then Bleep Lorp got merged with Hulu's programmatic analysis division. And now I'm the head of comedy at Hulu.
Hell yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty clever.
Yeah, I've just found it funny, like ironic with sitcoms, because when it was meant to be enjoyed as a single half hour unit, when we were airing it week to week, that's when it's at its most bingeable. It's when I want to watch 5 of them or 10 of them in a row. And yet when we actually make sitcoms that run over the course of a whole season on a streaming service, I'm not interested in those. The format of airing week to week seems to fit better for a situational comedy for me.
Yeah, I mean, that was always the dream of sitcoms, that every episode is a perfect little farce, right? Mm-hmm. You know the characters and you come back because you like the characters and the actors, but every individual episode should function on its own as a perfect little play, pulling from the tradition of popular entertainment, like theatrical experiences, where it's an event that you are going to the theater and you only get one chance to watch this thing, but adding to the serial nature of having a mass media broadcast. So yeah, I think lost a little is the idea of you should be able to drop into any single episode and watch it, which is hilarious because that we're talking about this in the context of Arrested Development, which is maybe the single thing most made not to be like that.
Yes. Yeah. And it's interesting. How influential do you see Arrested Development season 1-3 on later sitcoms and decades? Like, what shows do you think have some of that Arrested Development DNA, even if they don't quite bring it up to that Mitch Hurwitz level of ambition?
I mean, you could argue that it was the first show, that it was one of the key shows in kind of creating the docudrama format, because it's not supposed to be a doc, right? Yeah. But it does kind of have some of the trappings that it is, that there's like a, there are, that there's a, people filming this. It's not, it's like a group of people filming it. I don't know if you know what I mean. Like, it's got this doc.
Yeah, the single camera.
And the narration feeds into that as well. And then, you know, that ends up being incredibly influential. It becomes like the dividing line between, because like prestige concepts come for comedy too. And the big one is that if you want to be an actually good sitcom that people will take seriously and say is good and quality, then you better not have a laugh track, mm-hmm. and you better have the one camera thing. Mm-hmm. And then that created like a wine and beer track for sitcoms, where Chuck Lorre gets to make 10,000 multi-camera sitcoms that are watched by 50 billion people. And then there's a bunch of single camera, no laugh track sitcoms that are watched by the more refined audience.
Yeah, you're 30 Rock viewers.
AV Club. Yeah, exactly.
I didn't kind of realize this until I got into the show in the 2000s, but it's always fascinated me that Trailer Park Boys really came up with this idea, this whole format, before anybody else did. Just a bunch of idiosyncratic weirdos in Halifax or wherever they live.
Yes.
Coming up with this whole concept of like a mockumentary sitcom. Mm-hmm. Even before British Office, I believe, yep. they came out first. So I feel like those guys always need to get the stylistic credit for conceiving of that thing almost before on their own in a Canadian public television context before almost anyone else did.
Yeah. Easy there, Chris. We're both Canadian. It's we don't.
I mean, I'm giving
He's
them
praising
I'm
them. Giving,
yeah. Hey, yeah. Canadian comedy has over the last 50 years been one of the main generators of comedic innovation in the entire world. I don't know what it is about you guys in the frozen north. I think it is partially the kind of little brother nature to America. Is that there's a self examination there that leads to a kind of wry comedy of inadequacy or something.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's interesting that we're getting these innovations in television comedy from something like Trailer Park Boys, which has like a sort of a lowbrow audience. Although, I mean, its audience is everybody. And then something like Arrested Development, which was, to me, I always saw it as like cultural marker for watching the right type of television. If you like The Wire, like you also probably like Arrested Development. I remember putting my orange DVDs on my bookcase so I could be like, you know what, I like the good type of comedy. You know, if I had a friend or a date over or something.
Yeah.
It's that first Velvet Underground album that they brag about how it started all the other bands, right?
Well, it is tough because it's like, I can't really think of anything that actually does what this show does in even as similar as a way. I mean, my other favorite 21st century comedy series would be the one that is probably most similar to this, though I don't think that it is inspired by it at all, because it is also two guys working totally in isolation, which is Venture Brothers, which I've already brought up, which approaches the same over the long term, like intricateness of plotting, long term joke setup and payoffs, really, really deliberate pacing, character building, running jokes, character development. But I can't imagine, because these shows came out basically at the same time, I believe the pilot episode of Venture Brothers came out in 2003 as well. I'm sure that they probably enjoy Arrested Development, but I can't imagine that those guys were, because they're such animation and cartooning nerds, mm-hmm. comic book nerds, that's the context that they're coming out of. I can't imagine that they were watching like the first few seasons of Arrested Development going, we should be doing that with this show. But maybe.
Yeah.
Because it takes them so long to produce. They've done 7 seasons over the course of 20 years that I believe probably between the first season and second season of Venture Brothers, the entire run of Arrested Development might have come out. So maybe, mm-hmm. maybe.
I actually see, it's interesting, we're all going different directions, but I actually see Community as maybe the successor to Arrested Development in so many ways, in terms of callbacks, call forwards. I see in their episode where they do a fake clip show of stuff that never happened. That's like the tags at the end of Arrested Development. And much like Arrested Development, really tortured a network that didn't support them, firing the showrunner, and also brought back on streaming, except in the case of Community, it literally killed Yahoo Stream when they tried to get it.
Matt, what are your thoughts on Community? I don't think I've ever picked your brain about it.
I'm a fan. I like it a lot. I think it's one of the better sitcoms of that era, one of the better prestige sitcoms of the time. And it does, it's got the heart and the meta thing. And I enjoyed it at the time. Of those shows, of all of those, you know, sitcoms of that era, the one that I think is the best, the one that I think holds up the most, honestly, is 30 Rock. Though.
I agree. Mm-hmm. The acid perspective of 30 Rock is the thing that I think most accurately depicts the world that it came out of the best. And it's just so fucking funny.
So many jokes. Mm-hmm. Just they all hit too. It's insane.
Yes. Yeah. Just like Arrested Development is like, going back to 30 Rock, just the joke density of those shows, they might be the goats, truly.
Yeah. And I'd love to learn a bit about the production of 30 Rock. I really know next to nothing, but in researching this, like, Hurwitz wanted to get every little moment out that he could. So it was like one of the first sitcoms not to shoot on film, so he could film a lot more and keep costs down. And he wanted to do so many little cutaway gags on location. There were no craft services when they did this. Actors knew, like, you wouldn't get as big a paycheck if you come because we're trying to do something ambitious. And his first cut of any 21, 22 minute episode would be over 30 minutes. And so that's why on Arrested Development, characters don't knock. You don't hear a phone ring when they pick up the phone. He was really just trying to scrape every little thing he could in post to try and get just the funny in there. And I'm wondering if it was like as onerous and taxing for 30 Rock.
I think that is one of the things that's magical about the first three seasons of, well, actually, this is the same thing I was praising about season four as well, is that there is kind of this feeling that you get through watching Arrested Development of like panicked desperation that they like know that every second of this show that they are getting out is a miracle that they're letting this happen. And so you can like feel them scrambling to do everything that they want to do in every single moment. And I think that really comes through with that show, where you can sense the axe over the show's head at every moment going through. I feel like 30 Rock, I mean, because Tina Fey was such a star of comedy at that moment, that you feel a little more support from the network, you know, because it's NBC and they're trying to revitalize must-see TV. They're like, okay, we are betting it all on you giving us a new Friends. And certainly they joke about how they know that they are not giving NBC what they want, which is to make it, what is the joke? Make it 1997 again by Science or Magic.
Yes.
But I think that you can feel a little more long-term support of like, we get what you're doing, keep going for it. Whereas, you know, with Arrested Development, you get that sense of the gun to their head at every moment.
Yeah.
I got an idea for what you can do. Why don't you fucking fire your complete marketing team, all right? Get a new one in there, knows how to market a show that won 5 motherfucking Emmys, Golden Globes, SAG Awards, WGA Awards, DGA Awards, Producers Guild Awards, Critics Top 10 lists. You know, if you can't market that kind of show and get better ratings, then maybe the problem doesn't lie here. Maybe it lies with marketing. Good night.
Good night. Thank you very much.
Just to wrap up this question, I think the show that borrows the most from Arrested Development is How I Met Your Mother, in that it has a literal narrator as well. It frequently uses flashbacks, flash forwards, references to its own, you know, sort of dictionary. I see a lot of, and with a single camera show, you can do something like a 3-second flashback of J. Walter Weatherman getting his arm ripped off and have it be worth it more than if you have to set up a multi-camera stage setup.
Yeah, I think How I Met Your Mother tries to really split the difference. That's kind of what undercuts it. Is that it still has a laugh track. They claim that they recorded the laughter of a live studio audience and then piped it in afterwards. But they actually couldn't film it in front of a live studio audience. But they made it look as if they did, which is a very weird cut the baby in half kind of approach to making a sitcom.
Yeah, I enjoyed at least a few seasons of How I Met Your Mother. It is very of its moment in a way that is a little obnoxious now. It is that very first generation kind of, as we would say on Chapo and other people would say, epic bacon type of internet coolness and randomness put into things. But it's very clever and often, you know, pretty successful, heartwarming in that cheesy sitcom way. And great cast. Everybody on that show is fucking hilarious.
And just to take a moment and clarify what we mean by a single camera show, with the exception of the Larry Sanders Show, Arrested Development was an important forerunner in a certain type of TV show. Unlike sitcom of its time, like Friends or Will and Grace, Arrested Development helped modernize sitcom through its single camera style instead of a multi-camera setup. So what does that mean? You probably hear this term all the time. What does it mean? Multi-camera shows are shot on to look like a stage production. There's four cameras, they're affixed to the ground, they're almost always shot on a set, they're steady, there's a studio audience. It's shot like a play. Single camera shows like Arrested Development feel like reality TV. You know, in 2003, reality TV has colonized the minds of wine moms across America like an anti-vax conspiracy theory. It was like when England discovered sugar. People were drinking it until their teeth rotted out. That's what reality TV consumption looked like in the early 2000s. And that's what Arrested Development is meant to look like. You know, there's no studio audience. You have way more creative freedom to do cutaway gags, narration, flash forward, flashbacks, and in the case of something like The Office, intersperse your show with interview-like confessionals. And it lets the camera's vantage point have a personality of its own. It's reacting in real time to sounds or new input the way that a point-of-view person would. This allows them to do stuff like slowly reveal Buster being in the room as people talk about him.
Yeah. Okay, so do you want to wrap up? So Matt and Chris just dropped a pod on the 30 Years War. I don't have a flawless segue between Arrested Development and the 30 Years War, but I want to give them the floor to talk about it. I've listened to the first couple episodes. It's awesome. I guess if I were to try and do an Arrested Development segue, it would look something like this. If I may remove my podcaster's beanie and put on my armchair historian smoking jacket for a second and ask, in the spirit of Arrested Development, is there an ultimate fail son in the period that you are covering? Is there a legendary Joey-style fail son?
We just recorded the last episode, which is about, we go through 30 Years War, but then, you know, the culmination of the process is the creation of the modern English state, and that's the glorious revolution of 1688. But for that to happen, you first have to have Oliver Cromwell try to have his son Richard take over for him after he dies, and immediately completely allow the entire system to collapse. They basically do the I'll give you $100 to fuck off thing to him, and he just says, fair enough, I'm out of here. So I'd say tumble down Dick Cromwell for sure.
Yes, literally getting the historical epithet tumble down Dick. I mean, there are a lot of people. I would say that if I'm straining to do an Arrested Development segue, there are a lot of people in the story of the 30 Years War, in the story of Hell on Earth, who are inheriting something built by their more competent predecessors that is no longer functional and having to figure out how to keep everything together. And the ways that they try to figure out to keep everything together end up being a disaster and getting hundreds of thousands of people killed. So, you know, Tumble Down Dick Cromwell is probably the biggest fail son, but it's a lot of people who are not being able to keep up what their predecessors had put together.
Hell yeah, love it. So as I always close the show, I'd like to thank you for listening. I want to thank our guests, Chris and Matt, for joining. I want to remind you to like, subscribe, write us a review, give us 5 stars. And yeah, follow us on Twitter, even though we're not huge posters. We have, I think, 13 followers on Twitter. So.
And yeah, thank you very much. I listen to you guys on a lot of other podcasts, like on a lot of, you know, non-Hell on Earth podcasts, and you're always very generous with your time and spirits, and whenever I'm listening, I always enjoy it. So, and it's very clear just how much you're willing to help out other people, so thank you.
Oh, yeah, our pleasure.
Yeah, it is. It truly is our pleasure. It's, and I'm always happy to hop on pods, because I am happy to have the opportunity to podcast myself, so anybody you ask, I'll try to make time for.
Cool. You're gonna get some hop-ons.
Also, Matt, I just want to ask one history question while I have you.
Uh-huh.
I was at your show on Friday. I was wondering, is there a particular book you'd recommend on alchemists and magicians and Rosicrucians?
Well, the main book about the Rosicrucian phenomenon specifically, like the pamphlets and stuff, is this book called The Rosicrucian Enlightenment by Francis Yates.
Nice.
It's not that long. It's I think it was originally written in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And it's really it sketches out like the context in which the Rosicrucian pamphlets were dropped pretty well. But yeah, from then, if you want to get to like the actual like nitty gritty of occultism and stuff, there's any number of biographies of guys like John Dee that you could look at too.
I would honestly,
Giordano Bruno.
I would honestly recommend not reading a biography of John Dee. We both read separate biographies of him for the thing, and I think we both found them pretty boring. Mm. I think we successfully outlined why he's interesting, but actually reading about the nitty gritty of his life is just reading about a guy looking into pocket mirrors and trying to talk to angels and then begging everyone around him for money.
Hell yeah, love it. Yeah, because I've been reading the Wedgwood book. I was telling Chris before you hopped on. I've been reading the Wedgwood 30 Years War book, and it's good. It's a higher barrier to entry than I was expecting, but it's a solid read. I'm excited to hear your takes on Gustavus Adolphus.
Oh, we've got
a baby.
Thanks again. Bye-bye. Peace, y'all.
Bye, guys.
Later.
Next time on Remember Shuffle. The Shuffle Boys figure out just exactly what is a hipster, only to find out that they were studying themselves the whole time.